From KUSP Studios in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. Remy Stern is my guest. He is the author of a clever book entitled, But Wait, There's More. Tighten your abs, make millions, and learn how the $100 billion infomercial industry sold us everything but the kitchen sink. It's a book about infomercials, and it's funny and fascinating. Remy Stern, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Why haven't they sold us the kitchen sink? Wasn't there a kitchen sink infomercial?
There hasn't been one just yet, but it could come. You never know.
That could be our thing.
Maybe it would be a big seller. Who knows?
I'm sure they've had granite countertops, if not the sink. Well, you know, Remy Stern, I hate infomercials, and I avoid them like the plague. And one reason that I am so susceptible to them. You know, especially if they're about songs from the 60s or Dean Martin celebrity roasts on DVD, those are the ones that really get me.
They suck you in. That's part of what's so amazing about them, is they have the power to turn couch potatoes into consumers at 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's the thing. You know, how did the infomercials begin? Was it the pocket fisherman or the Vegematic or what?
Well, they were around in a different form. The half-hour infomercial was around in a different form in the 50s. They were called product demonstrations, and they were essentially infomercials. And then they disappeared at the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s, after the quiz show scandals had people in the government very concerned about advertisers' influence in television programming. They returned in the 80s under President Reagan when the rules were changed, and so 30-minute infomercials came back in the 80s. But all along there have been the shorter infomercials that are usually 60 seconds or 90 seconds, which they call in the industry short-form infomercials, and which are on the air to this day. So today they're sort of the two different kinds, the long ones and the short ones.
How does it differ from a commercial in that people have to call in?
Yeah, the big difference between that and a regular commercial is that there's a 1-800 number that appears on the screen, and viewers are urged to go and buy the product right that moment. That's what they call the call to action. So that's what they share in common, and what, you know, a commercial for a soft drink doesn't have.
Right. You can't call in right then and get a Pepsi. But it seems to me that maybe the root of the infomercial might be Ralph Williams, who was the Ford dealer in Southern California who used to host late-night movies, and he'd be on for a long time showing you the cars that were down there in the lot right then.
Yeah, there have always been people who've been trying to sort of incorporate commercial messages into television programming, and before that, radio. What I found so amazing and didn't really realize going into it was what a sort of story tradition the sort of pitch man who's been around for centuries and who would turn up in a town with a cart and have merchandise and launch into a pitch and get people to gather around, and it's really that same kind of person who's on the air today, and many of them actually got their start doing pitches in person.
With a little microphone on, you know, at the flea market, I even see people doing that. But what are some of the techniques that they've mastered to get me to buy the Dean Martin DVD?
Yeah, they're very clever. I mean, because they had to learn how to get people to buy products, at a state fair and get a crowd to gather around. They learned these little tricks that, you know, some of them are pretty obvious and some of them are a little bit more complex. So, they'll have a product, but it will never just be a standalone product. There's always, but wait, there's more. There's always something else that they put into the package to sort of constantly sort of sweeten it and make it look more and more appealing, which of course works because people think they're getting so much more than just a blender. And of course, throwing in a recipe booklet that costs them 10 cents to print, but you know, which they claim is worth $25. And so there's that, these efforts made to make it seem so much more appealing. And then, of course, the price discounting. So they'll always start with a really high price and slash the price and bring it down.
Now, how much would you pay?
Right. Yeah, that Ron Popeil is sort of the master at that. He would start at, you know, some absurd number, you know, $700, and then would eventually get down to
$19.95.
Four payments. So that's another trick they use, is they always break it into smaller payments, which you actually perceive, the total purchase price is less than, you know, if you say something is four payments of $24.99, it actually seems like less than $100. And that's been proven out by psychologists who've done studies on this, and it's sort of amazing. But it works, and that's why you never actually hear them utter the full price of the package. Then there are all sorts of other things. They often artificially put a price on shipping and handling that is far and above what the actual cost is to them. So they'll, you know, you'll buy something for $19.95 and it'll be an extra $14 shipping and handling, when of course, you know, it's coming to you by the slowest means possible.
It's the handling that's they're calling it handling. They can say whatever price they want, right?
Right. They can basically make up whatever price they want, except the thing is they don't often disclose what the handling is until you call. And once, of course, you've called, you've made a decision in your head to purchase the product, and very few people will be turned off and abandon the purchase because they hear that the handling is a few bucks more than they thought it was going to be. So it's a clever way for them to sort of embed more profit into the price of the product. So all these little things that they're using to maximize how much money they make and maximize the chance that they can get you to call.
The people who are doing the pitches, though, a lot of them have English accents. Is that to make us think they're smarter than we are?
That is exactly what it is. They found that hosts with English and, funnily enough, Australian accents, because we can't tell the difference between English and Australian accents, perform better, because we do think they have more authority, and they also have done tests on this and found that it's true that people perceive these English accents as more authoritative and are more likely to buy them. And of course, then at some point they realize we can't tell the difference between English and Australian accents, and so they became interchangeable. And so that's why they're still on the air to this day.
Now, do all those people actually have English accents, or have they learned to master them?
They're legit. They really are English and Australian accents. There's a sort of tradition of the English pitchman that it has gone on for years, and many of them are guys who were you know, on the streets of London selling mops, who came over here to sort of you know, hit the big time and go on television.
We're talking with Remy Stern, and his book is called "But Wait, There's More." Is it better to have a celebrity or just ordinary folk? It's kind of hurt the careers of some celebrities who have done infomercials, like Cher.
Yeah, in the early days, it was really the sort of thing that you did when your career, when you really had no other options, and it became associated with. Cher is a great example of someone who said that it ruined her career. That it was really the sort of thing that just made her even less desirable to Hollywood agents and casting directors. It's changed quite a bit since then. Nowadays, doesn't carry the same stigma. There is an enormous amount of money to be made these days, and some of the products are more upscale and not quite as cheesy as they were in the early days. So you know, celebrities can get away with it. But whether a celebrity appears in infomercial usually depends on what the product is and whether it sort of has this aspirational quality. You know, if it's sort of a makeup line and they want the makeup to look very glamorous, having a celebrity makes sense. If you're selling a blender or a mop, a celebrity isn't quite as needed. And people are pretty savvy about whether a celebrity endorsement seems legit or not. And so if you had a celebrity using some kitchen product, and we all know full well that the same celebrity never actually cooked, it would be harder to it'd be sort of a harder sell. Whereas, you know, for with a skincare line or you know, an acne treatment, we're a little bit more likely to sort of believe it.
I guess the George Foreman grill would be the ultimate celebrity thing, since it has his name in the product.
Yeah, and more celebrities, they're trying to get, instead of just having a celebrity just endorse a product, have that celebrity sort of be involved in the creation of the product, which is both better for the pitch, because then you sort of see that they're more involved, but then also can be extremely lucrative. George Foreman made $150 million when he sold the rights to his grill a few years ago.
Wow.
Which he said, you know, was
more than he'd made
many
boxing.
Times what he made during his career as a boxer.
Would tell it again, $100 million?
$150 million, because he actually owned part of the rights to the product, and he sold it back to the manufacturer for that. And,
that's
know,
insane. I wonder what they'd pay for the Gary Shapiro grill. Probably not as much. But now, in your book, you talk about going and meeting Ron Popeil, who I guess is the father of the infomercial. Tell us a little bit about your encounter with him.
Yeah, he's really the sort of godfather of the business, and has been doing this for more than 50 years now, pitching at least. And his father and his uncle and other members of his family have been in the business as well. So it's really sort of in his blood. And now he's in his 70s and semi-retired and living in Beverly Hills in this incredible mansion that I had an opportunity to go and visit him and spend some time with him. And he's really a character and still working. He has this garage that is right next to his house that he's converted into a sort of a workshop where he has, I think, every kitchen appliance I think has ever been invented. It's just full of gizmos and gadgets he's purchased, which he tests out, and he'll open them up to see how they work. And he's working on a new product, but he has to look at all the competition. And he's in his work coat. tinkering like a 9-year-old boy. I mean, it's really kind of amazing, and you know, he's sort of a different sort than you see on television these days. I mean, he's sort of an inventor and a pitchman, and it rolled into one.
What was his first product? The Pocket Fisherman, or something before that?
The Pocket Fisherman was a very early one. That was actually invented by his father, S.J. Popeil, who had Ron film the commercials. So
I see.
It was Ron's voice in the commercials that he wasn't in them, but you could hear his voice in the background. That's how he really got it. He got his start working for his father, and eventually started his own company. And he's had so many products over the years that would be one of his most famous early products. But he's had sort of one hit after another.
The Vegematic, was that his?
The Vegematic was also his father's.
And slices, and dices.
Right, and the Chop-O-Matic, the Dial-O-Matic. There was the whole O-Matic line, which was first introduced in the 50s, and then there was they came along, and the Vegematic came afterwards in the 60s. He had Mr. Microphone, which is a popular one, which was really popular for a couple of years until there were about 12 companies making exactly the same thing, which was that microphone so you could hear yourself on the radio.
That's how I got in the business.
I remember that problem. That was sort of the thing that every kid wanted to have. More recent years, he's had the Popeil pasta maker, the Showtime rotisserie.
That was big, the Showtime rotisserie.
That was very big. He had GLH, which was the spray-on hair.
Yes.
Was another famous product of his. The GLH, I think it was GLH number 9, and the GLH stood for great-looking hair, which was a fun show.
But did anybody actually buy the product?
The spray-on hair?
Yeah.
I think they bought it once. I'm not sure if they would ever come back and buy it again.
I see. Because it's spray paint, essentially, right?
It's spray paint, and I actually bought some. you can still find some, and I actually tested it out.
And was it convincing at all? Really?
You know, it looks pretty good from about 20 feet. when you get up close, it's not so believable. But from a distance, it works.
Well, I guess if you're on TV, it would work, then.
It would. The big problem I found, though, was that if it if you sweat just a little bit, it comes running down your face.
Well, that would be a definite.
Yeah, it's paint.
problem.
Couldn't go out on a warm day or in the rain.
We're talking with Remy Stern, and his book about the infomercial industry is called But Wait, There's More. Well, would that paint be the most bizarre, that we're talking about that hair paint, would that be the most bizarre product of the infomercial line, or can you think of something more bizarre?
There are some really bizarre products that have come along over the years. One other hair product that was very amusing at the time was the Flowbee, which was this apparatus that you hooked up to your vacuum cleaner that could cut your hair. It looks completely goofy, and you could give yourself a haircut so you wouldn't have to go to the barber.
What was that other little haircut thing that your mom could cut your hair with? And then they'd show kids just like looking horrible, and their mother had cut it with a little tiny thing that was basically a razor blade, I guess. It was a holder for a razor blade.
Yeah, there were a few other as often the case when one product appears and there are six others right behind it. That was a very silly one. I think one of the silliest that I remember from the this is probably from the early 90s was a product called the Aroma Trim, which was this little disc that you were supposed to carry in your pocket, and whenever you were hungry you were supposed to take it out and smell it, and it gave off such a foul odor that it would ruin your appetite and you wouldn't be able to eat. And what was so great was the infomercial. They were on the boardwalk in Venice with a big giant plate of chocolate chip cookies and the Aroma Trim, and they would go up to people and ask them if they wanted a chocolate chip cookie, and of course they would go and reach for the cookie, and then they would put the Aroma Trim under their nose, and then of course instantly everybody who had wanted a chocolate chip cookie was suddenly repulsed by the thought of eating it. That was a really wacky one, but it apparently gave off such a stench.
But if you carried it in your pocket, no one would talk to you.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you'd carry that around.
Well, has the financial downturn affected the infomercial business now?
It's so strange because it's actually been a boom time for them because of the recession, because the price of advertising has gone down, and all these big brands have pulled back and reduced their budgets for TV advertising, and of course it's the infomercial guys who come in and buy up the cheap time and fill the void. So they're buying more time than ever right now, which is why everybody's talking about these products like the Snuggie and the ShamWow and these guys are sort of cashing in, taking advantage. So it's actually a really there are very few industries that are doing well in the recession. On repossession agents and bankruptcy attorneys and infomercial producers.
Well, here's the mystery that maybe you can solve for us, Remy Stern. There's cable TV with 175 channels or more, I don't know, 1,001 channels, whatever it is. There's TiVo where you can store, hundreds of hours of programming. There's DVD players. Why would anybody intentionally turn on an infomercial?
That's the sort of dilemma for them in the future, which is something they've been grappling with for the last few years, is what happens in a day and age when you don't actually have to flip channels anymore. One of the things that they relied on was the ability to sort of snag a viewer as they were changing channels, and they would put on all these goofy characters and these kind of crazy presentations, because that would be what would get people to stop changing channels.
Women with big breasts was big there, right?
Yeah. They anything to get people to stop. So all the Get Rich infomercials, which were targeted to men, featured women in these like tight tops and low-cut shirts and really kind of crazy characters like the Matthew Lesko, who is that guy with a question mark all over his suit, or Or Tony Little, who looked like he was going to have a heart attack because he had so much energy, or you know, these sort of really wild characters. But what happens when you don't actually need to flip channels because you just have everything on your DVR or TiVo? So that's going to be the sort of big question for them. The short spots are immune to some degree because they appear during regular programming, although people will still be able to skip by them, but
yeah.
That's the same with any commercial.
Right.
But those 30-minute infomercials are the ones that are their future is in jeopardy. They sort of rely to some degree on the sort of kitsch factor. People watch them because they're sometimes so silly and amusing. I mean, I would often watch them years ago just for the humor value because they were so kind of outlandish and silly.
But before you knew it, you had a Vegematic.
Right, that was the thing. I would watch them, and then I would buy them. And
because you know, if you don't order in the next 5 minutes, you know they may all be gone. What happens if you don't order in the next 5 minutes?
Yeah, that's another total sales tactic. There is no way they have to track. It's the same infomercial in hundreds of markets around the country, airing all the time. They have no way of tracking that. So that whole sort of act now in the next 15 minutes and. Is all baloney. As is, you know, the idea that their inventory is running low and
limited supply.
You know, it's all these really clever psychological tactics. On home shopping networks, for example, nowadays they often show you how many products are being sold. So you see the counters actually going up, and they're telling you, you know, how many units they've sold. And I joke in the book that, you know, the only person who cares about that number really is their accountant, who's tracking how much money they're making, but that's a great psychological tactic.
Well, I guess it's like, you know, now that they one of the things that's become a news item in recent years is which movie is the top box office draw. So it's like, I guess if everybody's going to see that movie, then I should go see it, even if it's a piece of crap.
Yeah, it's sort of the crowd effect. It's if you see there are 3,000 people who in the last 15 minutes purchased this new flat screen television, you think maybe you're missing out. There are all these people are clearly, captivated by this new TV and are buying it. And why am I not buying it? So, it's another. They're so subtle, but they work. And the amazing thing about infomercials and home shopping is that they can test to see if it works, because the phone rings or it doesn't ring.
Right.
And if it doesn't work, they can change the infomercial. They'll edit it. They'll try it without, you know, the counter in the corner with the counter. They'll change the script slightly, and they will just test it and see if which results in the most sales. And so they have this sort of built-in Nielsen rating.
Well, I think the ShamWow and some of the other ones are really internet driven. Yeah, or am I wrong about that? Just because I see it in my email every day.
They, for whatever reason, sort of like became these sort of internet hits when people are talking about them, and
the
Snuggie has formed these their fan clubs now, and the people who are getting together all dressed in their Snuggies, and that's one of the ways that they're trying to sort of exist in the future, is by branching out and being more internet driven. And not as reliant on television, although it's often television that creates that sort of spark that results in a sort of an internet sensation. Both those products are doing very well, and you know, it's not always clear why they do well. For example, the ShamWow has been around for years and years. I remember as a kid seeing similar products at street fairs. It's not a new product by any means.
It's a piece of leather or whatever it is. What is it?
it's a absorbent towel that is synthetic and is absorbs liquid. I mean, it's nothing. It's a glorified sponge. Is what it is.
I mean, what is the ratio between cost and sales on that?
On that, it depends on the product, but that is very cheap to manufacture. What the cost when you buy a product like that for, let's say, $20, you know, $18 of the dollars goes to buy the airtime to advertise it, the cost is so minimal. I mean, even the products that are expensive, you know, the Magic Bullet blender, for example, which I think, you know, is $99. That's an $8 cost to them to make, which is why they, you know, the big sort of finale is that they'll give you two for the price of one, which is like, you know, some people are like, wow, how generous! But you know, it's $16 for them instead of, you know, $8. Yeah, there's a huge markup, which is sort of necessary, because then they'd never be able to spend all that money advertising it. If the margins were slim, but you know, the Snuggie is just a piece of fabric that where they cut out little holes for your arm so you can wear a blanket.
You would never think of cutting a hole in your own blanket and just wearing it.
Well, you know, it's funny because there was a product called the Slanket, which came along a few years ago, which was exactly the same thing.
Is it timing or what?
What's that?
Is it just timing or what?
It's timing, and it's sort of a weird sort of X factor. I mean, I think, and with the Snuggie, it's sort of the cultural mood of the country that I think has something to do with it. When I saw it was becoming really popular, I was reminded of what someone at the Home Shopping Network told me, which is that right after September 11th, they noticed that the sales of bedding went through the roof, and they explained it because they said, well, people just want to be really comfortable in their beds while they're watching this sort of horrible news on television. And I sort of thought that the same thing was taking place with the Snuggie, that, you know, in this sort of unsettling time that we live in, the idea that, you know, there was this little thing that was going to just make you so much cozier on the couch had a sort of strange appeal. There's something sort of genius and scary about how the products often sort of fit into the sort of cultural mood of the country. I mean, all the get-rich infomercials have now been edited to reflect the economic crisis, which I just find just amazing, because now you watch them and they're referencing all the things that we see in the news every day.
Well, the book is called But Wait, There's More. Tighten Your Abs, Make Millions, and Learn How the 100 Billion Infomercial Industry Sold Us Everything But the Kitchen Sink. And the book, by the way, is available now. I believe that the quantities are limited. And how much would you pay for this book? $25? No. It's only $24.99. So the author is Remy Stern. Thanks for visiting with us today, Remy.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Time flies when you're having fun. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. I hope you'll come back again next week for another From the Bookshelf. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.